Marine Drive. Work officially began on Marine Drive on the 30th of March 1897, when the Mayor laid the foundation stone as part of Scarborough's celebration for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. The project was intended to be both a marine carriage drive and a sea defence. The headland had lost 3.5 acres over the last 50 years due to erosion. The opportunity to develop a new tourist attraction connecting both of Scarborough Bays and protect the shoreline appealed to the council, who borrowed a considerable sum of money, estimating in 1897 the project would cost around £70,000 and take 3 years. Not all were in favour, though. Lord Lonsborough opposed the reshaping of the headland on aesthetic grounds. Instead of the grand rugged rock to which one is accustomed, he wrote, there is now what appears a monstrous railway embankment. It does seem folly, more than that, a crime, to destroy one of the principal attractions of Scarborough and its greatest beauty. They had certainly underestimated the scale of the task. Storms would repeatedly wash away their work, sending costs spiralling and setting back deadlines by years. The fierce storms of January 1905 were the most serious of the many which damaged Marine Drive. The council had planned for a summer opening by the Prince of Wales that year, and locals had been allowed to walk the road that very month. The last block had been laid by the mayoress in October 1904. The force of the waves scooped out the material used for the roadway, which was awaiting surfacing. Later in the morning, the roadway was converted into a torrent, wrote the Guardian. Iron fencing was destroyed, while workmen's huts were demolished, whilst the locomotive was buried in the debris. The steam-powered cranes and railway tracks were particularly vulnerable to storms. The seawall itself was left with large cracks. Engineers found it was practically necessary to build another wall in front of a portion 428 feet long, and that there was no hope of opening soon. During the January storm, the 1,000-foot-long North Promenade Pier, which had stood since 1869, was almost entirely washed away by the combination of the wind and tides. Only the isolated pavilion at the seaward end remained. It was not rebuilt. While work on Marine Drive continued throughout, locals wondered if the project would ever be finished. The original public works contractor went bankrupt and blamed the storm damage to Marine Drive. Holderness MP Stanley Wilson condemned the project in 1906 as an extravagance by the Scarborough Corporation and a mistake. Marine Drive was finally opened on July the 27th, 1908. Over 11 years in construction and costing over £120,000 at opening, the event was marked by a royal ceremony. The Duke of Connaught, brother of the King, alongside his wife and daughter Princess Patricia, who were hosted at Lonsborough Lodge and the Royal Hotel, declared the road open. The day was observed as a general holiday, crowds lining the streets to watch the royal procession down Victoria Road to Castle Road, then Queen's Parade and Royal Albert Drive. The Duke inspected local veterans of the Crimean War and the Indian Mutiny, and was later credited with securing a pension for one veteran who was then an inmate at Scarborough Workhouse. While wind and rain tarnished the town's decorations, it takes a lot to damp the ardour of North Country people, wrote the Times. The Duke assures locals that while it had cost much in time, money and anxiety, they could be proud of having made one of the finest drives, certainly in the United Kingdom, if not possibly the world. The road was 4,200 feet long, with a seawall 40 feet high.
The Civil War. The English civil wars were really a series of conflicts in the 17th century between the supporters of Parliament, known as the Roundheads, and the supporters of King Charles I, the Royalists, or the Cavaliers. The fundamental issue was whether the monarch or Parliament should be in control of government. The King was eventually tried and executed in 1649, and Parliament achieved victory in 1651. The impact of the war on Scarborough was greatest in 1645, when a parliamentary army fought to capture Scarborough Castle from the Royalist forces. The parliamentarians had already defeated a Royalist army in 1644 at the Battle of Marston Moor, near York, and the city of York had surrendered. Seizing control of an isolated Scarborough and its castle would afford greater strategic influence over North Sea shipping. The parliamentary forces used some of England's biggest artillery to break the siege. One cannon capable of firing iron balls weighing 65 pounds was sighted in the chancel of St Mary's Church and fired repeatedly through the great east window. Fire from this range succeeded in splitting the castle keep in two. When the Royalist forces returned fire, they badly damaged the church, which was also suffering from the vibrations caused by the parliamentary artillery. The siege ended on the 25th of July 1645, when the Royalist garrison surrendered, weakened by a high casualty rate, disease and starvation. A second siege of the castle took place in 1648, when, again, parliamentary forces besieged a royal garrison, resulting in a parliamentary victory. The legacy of the civil wars remains evident in the town. Oliver's Mount appears to have been named in tribute to the parliamentary leader, Oliver Cromwell, despite the fact that he had no direct involvement in any civil war activity in the town. Similarly, the remains of a military structure overlooking North Bay have traditionally been referred to as Oliver's Battery. Most strikingly, the ruins of the eastern end of St Mary's Church and of the Great East Window are still visible as if half-ruined castle keep.
Skipping Day. While the first mention of skipping on Shrove Tuesday is from 1903, Scarborough has long treated Shrove Tuesday as a special holiday. In the 19th century, and possibly earlier, shopkeepers closed their businesses at noon to give their workers the half day off. This holiday became particularly important to children. In the Victorian period, Scarborians referred to Shrove Tuesday as Ball Day, as children played various ball games on the beach amid other festivities. These games involved football, as is traditional on Shrove Tuesday in a number of towns, and battledore and shuttlecock, a forerunner of badminton. Sweet sellers set up their stalls and traders erected game stalls in anticipation. The origins of the tradition of skipping in Scarborough are unclear, but in the early 20th century, it became the main focus of children's play, and the day became known as Skipping Day. The availability of surplus rope from the fishing industry, as fishermen repaired their nets, may have helped. The practice of providing school children with a half-day holiday in order to take part in the celebrations continues today. Closing the foreshore road to traffic allows room for individual and multiple skipping, both activities being so perfectly illustrated by two pupils of Gladstone Road Primary School on the seawall storyboard. In addition to skipping, the old custom of ringing the pancake bell continues in Scarborough. For centuries, bells were rung to call people to church to confess before the beginning of Lent. But this bell ringing came to be seen as a call to housewives to begin making pancakes in order to use up leftover eggs and butter before fasting for Lent. The mayor still rings the bell at the corner of North Street and Newborough at noon to mark the beginning of festivities, which also includes the annual pancake race. The winner is awarded with the golden frying pan. Before 1861, a bell on St. Thomas's Hospital on North Street was rung on Shrove Tuesday, before it was moved to the Rotunda, and in 1996 the ceremony returned to North Street.
The railway station. This was designed by George Townsend Andrews. Scarborough Station, now a Grade 2 listed building, was built for the York and North Midland Railway and opened in July 1845. It is said that 10 to 15,000 onlookers saw the first train arrive, consisting of 35 passenger coaches and hauled by two locomotives. The arrival of the railway heralded a major injection of investment into the town, particularly for the holiday and tourism trade. The building was much admired and the Leeds Times praised it highly, writing that the buildings are quite as extensive as York and more handsome. They're in the Italian style and have a beautiful colonnade in front. The building still retains the original wood and glass, one of the earliest train shed canopies in the world. In 1882, the clock tower was added, along with a new frontage, though this was met less favourably by critics. In 1883, as a result of Scarborough's growing tourist trade, North Eastern Railway spent £4,000 on improvements, including a 456 feet long bench built by William Bell to accommodate up to 30 passengers. By the end of the 19th century, the station's platforms could not cope with the volumes of passengers who arrived by excursion trains, and there was no room to expand the station. The solution developed by North Eastern Railways was to build a new extension station about half a mile short of the main station. This was opened in June 1908. The station was initially named Washbeck Excursion Station, later renamed Lonsborough Road Station. As package holidays developed, the size of the excursion trains reduced, relieving pressure on the station. And the last train to depart from Lonsborough Road Station was in August 1963, and it was officially closed in July 1966.
Scarborough Cricket Club was formed in 1849, their first match being played against Filey on rough ground opposite the Queen's Hotel. As the club developed, important matches were played at Castle Hill on ground prepared by the army for the local rifle volunteers, but the practice of the riflemen was often in conflict with matches. In 1862, a match was organised between the Scarborough 20 players and an All England 11 at Castle Hill, which drew large crowds and subsequently became an annual event. The club moved to the North Marine Road ground in 1963. On the 27th of August 1868, Scarborough played the touring Australian Aboriginals team, the first organised sporting team to travel overseas from Australia, the visitors winning by 10 wickets. International sporting contact was rare in this era. Only three overseas cricket tours had previously been played, all English tours to the USA and Canada in 1859, and Australia in 1861-62 and 1863-64. Yorkshire first played at the Marine Road ground in 1878, when MCC beat them by 7 wickets. The first county championship game was held here in 1896, with Yorkshire beating Leicestershire by 162 runs. Scarborough remains as the only regular county cricket venue in Yorkshire, other than Headingley in Leeds. Scarborough Cricket Festival is an end-of-season series of matches featuring Yorkshire County Cricket Club and various county, touring and invitational teams. Many of the world's greatest cricketers have played in the festival matches over the years. In 1925, Yorkshire's own Sir Len Hutton hit 241. The highest innings in festival history came when Ken Rutherford, the former New Zealand captain, smashed 317 in a day for the New Zealand tourists in 1986. The North Marine Road Ground has staged two men's one-day international matches. When England played the West Indies in 1976, the tourists won by 6 wickets, with the great West Indian Sir Vivian Richards scoring 119 not out. Against New Zealand in 1978, England won by 19 runs, with England's Graham Gooch top scoring with 94. The ground also hosted England women's first of a two-set match series against Australian women in June 1951, which resulted in a draw. In August 2004, Scarborough hosted the only test match between England women and a touring New Zealand women's team. This match was also drawn with England's Charlotte Edwards scoring 117. Scarborough Cricket Club have an unsurpassed record of being 5-time winners of the English Cricket Board National Cricket Club Championship. Scarborough Cricket Club won the national knockout completion in 1972 and the Hague Trophy on 4 further occasions in 1976, 1979, 1981 and 1982.
The Open Air Theatre. Scarborough's Open Air Theatre, built with 7,000 seats, a stage 170 feet long costing £11,000 to build, was part of Borough Engineer Harry Smith's £50,000 project to create Northstead Manor Gardens. The stage was on an island in a lake between two slopes, on which the seats were constructed, providing good natural acoustics. The theatre was leased by the council to Scarborough Operatic and Dramatic Society, who produced the shows. They specialised in light and comic opera in the early years, putting on around 50 shows of each production twice weekly over the summer season. Later, these took on a grander scale. In 1934, Hiawatha employed 430 people in its chorus, ballet and orchestra. And Carmen, in 1935, involved ballet dancing on what was described as an under-lighted glass raft which glides on the dark waters. Being in the open air had some downsides. Shows had to be organised on Mondays and Thursdays, with the option to be repeated the following day in case of rain, and refunds issued if they were cancelled on both days, although this was thankfully rare.
Dinosaurs. The Yorkshire coast has been popular with geologists for many generations. Dating back as far as 200 million years, rocks from the Middle Jurassic period are exposed along the coastline. They're mainly of sandstone containing many plant fossils. This coast is known as the Dinosaur Coast. Around 170 million years ago, the land that is now Scarborough was in a very different location, roughly where Morocco is today. At the beginning of the Jurassic period, this area was covered by warm tropical seas, which became river deltas as sea levels sank. The seas were home to Ichthyosaurus and Plesiosaurs. In the deltas, and a variety of dinosaurs, plant-eating sauropods and carnivorous theropods flourished. Dinosaurs left footprints in the sand, silt and mud of the beaches and river deltas, and some of these can be seen on rocks at Burniston and Scolby near Scarborough. Although finding dinosaur bones is extremely rare along the Yorkshire coast, the foot bone of a sauropod has been found at Scarborough. In April 2021, the largest dinosaur footprint ever found in Yorkshire was spotted by a member of the public. Experts believe it was left by a large meat-eating dinosaur, possibly a Megalosaurus, with a body length of up to 30 feet, 9 metres. It was discovered in November 2020 by a fossil collector, but its importance has initially gone unnoticed. Some of these dinosaur footprints can be found in Scarborough's Rotunda Museum, situated on Valley Road near the Spa Bridge. It opened in 1829 as the first purpose-built museum and based on a design by William Smith, known as the Father of English Geology. Smith created the first geological map of England, Wales and parts of Scotland, and this map can also be seen in the Rotunda, which houses one of the finest collections of Jurassic geology on the Yorkshire coast. In the Georgian Gallery, visitors can admire a frieze created by John Phillips, the nephew of William Smith, and author of one of the world's first local geological books. The Speton plesiosaur, discovered near Filey in 2001 by a fossil collector, is a 4.5 metre skeleton of a rarely found Lower Cretaceous plesiosaur. Almost complete, apart from its head, this specimen was donated to the Rotunda.
World War II. Scarborough endured more than 20 air raids during the Second World War. Very extensive damage was done when a single enemy parachute mine was dropped on the old town on the 10th of October 1940, killing four people and completely destroying 11 properties and damaging a further 500. The worst air attack was the Scarborough Blitz on the 18th of March 1941, when nearly 100 planes spent an uninterrupted 2 hours bombing the town with explosive and incendiary bombs, killing 29 people. There has long been an urban myth that Hitler instructed his forces to avoid hitting the Grand Hotel, because he wished to use it for himself after conquering Britain. But the Grand was hit during the Blitz of that March. In 1940, local fishermen fought enemy planes from their armed fishing boats. Many younger fishermen joined the Royal Navy and deployed their fishing skills on Navy minesweepers, a highly dangerous job. And whilst some tourism continued during the war, it was badly affected by the fear of air raids, the challenges of wartime travel, the requisition of hotels by the military and the fortification of the beaches against invasion. Nearly 10,000 young evacuees were sent to the resort from the most at-risk ports and cities, including Hull, Hartlepool, Middlesbrough and London. And many stayed until the end of the war and developed a lifelong love for the town. Women played an important part in wartime Scarborough. They volunteered in the Women's Voluntary Service, the Land Army and the National Fire Service, and they worked on the buses and in fishing and other industries like Plaxton's and Premier Engineering. In many ways, the war enhanced the status of women in British and local society, and the war saw the election of the town's first female mayor, Louisa Whitfield Mansfield.
Sir George Cayley. Sir George Cayley is believed to have been born at Paradise House near St Mary's Church, Scarborough, although St Nicholas Street has also been claimed. He had a good scientific education and inherited his family's estate at Brompton near Scarborough. He was a founding member of the Scarborough Philosophical Society and became an MP for Scarborough in 1832. He was an engineer, inventor and aviator, and is one of the most important people in the history of aeronautics. Many consider him to be the first true scientific aerial investigator and the first person to understand the underlying principles and forces on a potential flying machine, having undertaken that work in the early 1800s. Today, George Cayley is known as the father of aeronautics. He abandoned older theories of flight, based on copying birds with flapping wings, in favour of building a machine which created thrust with separate curved wings and a tail to create lift. A flight test of his glider in 1853 in Brompton, manned by his nearly 80-year-old coachman, became the first fixed-winged aircraft to travel 900 feet across Brompton Dale. After surviving the crash landing, the coachman told Kaylee, "I wish to give notice. I was hired to drive and not to fly." Sir Richard Branson replicated the flight on its 150th anniversary. Wilbur Wright, who alongside his brother Orville achieved the first powered flight in 1909, said that about 100 years ago, an Englishman, Sir George Cayley, carried the science of flying to a point which had never been reached before, and which it scarcely reached again during the last century. As an inventor, Cayley did not only experiment with flight. He built an artificial hand for the son of one of his tenants, invented tension-spoked wheels in 1808, a universal railway, forerunner of caterpillar tracks, and designed a gunpowder engine which was intended to power his flying machines.
Roman Fort and Castle Headland. Britain was a province of the Roman Empire from 43 AD until the year 410. The Romans moved northwards, reaching York by 71 AD, when they established a fort following their defeat of the Celtic tribe, the Brigantes, who had settlements in places like York, Aldborough and Catterick. Wild York, Eboracum as it was called by the Romans, became a crucial Roman military centre. No defensive structures were built along the sparsely populated Yorkshire coast until around 370 AD, when an almost 60-kilometre chain of signal stations was built, stretching from Hultcliffe, which is by Saltburn-by-the-Sea in the north, to Flamborough Head in the south. Five have been identified in Hultcliffe: Goldsborough, has found a mound, Ravenscar, a sandstone slab with an inscription, and Scarborough, there is evidence on the headland, and at Filey, and at Flamborough Head. These coastal signal stations, the largest English example being Saxon Shore in the southeast, used fire and smoke to warn the authorities of raids by the Picts, the Gauls and the Saxons from the sea, in order to protect the rich farming land and wealthy villas between the coast and York. Scarborough's signal station was discovered in the 1920s, at the edge of the headland, although some had been lost to coastal erosion. Like the rest of the chain, the station consisted of a square fortified tower estimated to be as tall as the current castle keep, which is perhaps 27 to 30 metres high. It was defended by a deep ditch and curtain wall with a gatehouse before a courtyard. Unlike the lack of archaeological evidence for any Anglo-Saxon settlement in Scarborough, the Romans left more than just a signal station. Coins from the harbour and quern stones and pottery fragments from near the modern town centre have also been found. A possible Roman palace has also been recently discovered, which is currently subject to intensive investigation.
Florence Balgarnie. Florence Balgarnie was born in Scarborough in 1856, the daughter of Reverend Robert Balgarnie. Florence became the secretary of the town's university extension scheme, which provided accessible lectures to the community, and in 1883 won an election to the Scarborough School Board, the first woman to do so. Her organisational and public speaking skills led her to London, where she became secretary to the Central National Society for Women's Suffrage. In this role, she lectured and also lobbied politicians to support women's rights to vote, and attended women's rights conferences in Paris and Washington, D.C. She became known as one of the best women speakers of her day. She remained involved in politics all her life. As a member of the Women's Liberal Federation, she pushed her party to support women's rights and helped organise working women's trades unions in London's East End. She also joined with the British Women's Temperance Association to campaign against the alcohol trade. Her major personal successes included persuading the Home Secretary to appoint female police matrons in prisons to better care for female prisoners, and also for women factory inspectors. As a travelling journalist and lecturer, she shared her experiences gained abroad of prisons, alcohol laws and women's rights in order to bring best practices into use in Britain. Florence was also involved in international campaigning, inspired by Ida B. Wells' movement against the lynching of African Americans. She helped form the British Anti-Lynching Committee, which made her unpopular in much of the British and American press. In 1903, she was the only European elected to the Indian National Congress in Madras, telling the delegates that, "You may trust me to raise my voice on behalf of India." At home, she was involved in the peace movement and was an implacable opponent of the British Empire's actions in the Boer War. She died in 1928, aged 72, in Florence, whilst travelling in Italy.
Star Car. The archaeological site at Star Car has been described as the most important Mesolithic site in Britain and one of the world's most important. The Mesolithic is the Middle Stone Age, from around 11,000 to 4,000 years ago. Britain at the time was inhabited by hunter-gatherers who had moved northwards as the last ice age came to an end, around 10,000 to 9,000 years ago, while Britain was still attached to the continent. The Star Car site was situated on the edge of an ancient lake, Lake Flixton, and the peaty conditions had provided unusually well-preserved organic material like animal bones and wood, and these have enabled a new understanding of how Mesolithic people lived. The site was first uncovered by John Moore in 1947, who first found a piece of worked flint in the Carr lands between Flixton and Scarborough. Successive digs have revealed nearly 200 barbed points, which were used for hunting, representing 95% of those found in Britain, together with horse bones, flint tools and a boat paddle. The most iconic finds from Star Car are the headdresses made from deer skulls, with three holes drilled in the back so they can be worn. These are the only examples ever found in Britain, and archaeologists have suggested that they were ceremonial headdresses, and some of these can be seen at the Rotunda. In 2010, archaeologists discovered the remains of a house which was dated to roughly 8,500 BC, making it the oldest house in Britain. It consists of a circular hollow, 3.5 metres across, and surrounded by 18 post holes, with the suggestions of a hearth inside and a site for making tools like arrows and axes. This house was occupied over a long period, suggesting that hunter-gatherers were more settled than had previously been thought. Star Car also includes a long wooden platform, over 10 metres long, once on the lake's edge, with evidence of the oldest carpentry in Europe, although the precise use is unclear. An engraved shale pendant, discovered in 2015 at Star Car, covered in mysterious criss-crossing lines, is the only one of its kind found in Britain, and the country's oldest Mesolithic art.
GCHQ. According to GCHQ director Jeremy Fleming, Scarborough is home to the oldest continually operated signals collection site in the world. Its history began in 1912 on Sandy Bed Lane, on the western outskirts of the town, where the Admiralty founded a wireless telegraphy station to transmit and receive British naval communications. Not long afterwards, the First World War and new technology encouraged the development of signals intelligence the systematic collection and decoding of communications. And Scarborough began intercepting German naval communications, which they sent to London to be decrypted. The station quadrupled in size during the war. The current site of GCHQ Scarborough was obtained during the Second World War by the Admiralty, the land being the former home of Scarborough Racecourse. Amazingly, they were able to relocate to their new bomb-proof bunker from Sandy Bed Lane overnight on the 1st of March 1943, without any suspension of their work. This was a time of rapid growth for Scarborough's signals intelligence, which employed military, including women from the Women's Royal Navy Service, and civilian personnel. The Scarborough station had a teleprinter line to Bletchley Park and was part of the Admiralty's Direction Finding, DF, network, which located German battleships, U-boats, tankers and supply ships. It was the DF control at Scarborough that plotted the German battleship Bismarck, having intercepted a message from Admiral Lütjens verifying that she was heading for France. Along with information from other sites, this led to its sinking just days later. Following the end of the Second World War, the site's main focus was the interception of Soviet communications. Scarborough's routine mission of monitoring Soviet naval high command and Soviet merchant vessels became crucial during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the station was able to report that Soviet ships, potentially carrying medium-range ballistic missiles, had turned back home instead of attempting to break the American blockade of the island. The current buildings opened in 1974. And by 1981, 538 people were working there. The site took on its current name, GCHQ Scarborough, in 2001 and celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2014 with a visit from GCHQ patron Prince Charles, now King Charles III.
Scarborough's first lifeboat was built in 1801. And was the second operational lifeboat to be built in the UK. It was 30 feet long and fitted with 10 oars. It was commissioned by a boat builder, Charles Smith, at a cost of £147, funded by local donations. It saw active service almost immediately when it was called out to rescue the crew of seven from the Aurora of Newcastle. The lifeboat was originally manned by fishermen, who in those days deliberately did not learn to swim. This was because if they did get washed into the sea, death from drowning would come quickly. Today, all lifeboatmen have to be able to swim to a certain standard in order to be allowed to join a crew. One famous name will always stand out in the history of Scarborough lifeboats, and that's John Austin, who was coxswain for 41 years before retiring in 1911. Altogether, he took part in the rescue of 230 lives in peril, and was awarded the Silver Medal for Gallantry in October 1880 after the lifeboat was called out five times during a 24-hour long storm and rescued every one of 28 lives in danger. In 1902, King Edward VII presented him with a silver commemorative gift in honour of his distinguished service. Scarborough's current lifeboat can usually be viewed in the South Bay on most days. Since 1824, lifeboats have been under the jurisdiction of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, and it is independent of government and funded from donations.
Scarborough Fair. In 1253, King Henry III issued a royal charter granting the borough of Scarborough the right to hold an annual fair lasting 45 days. From the 15th of August, the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, until the 29th of September, Michaelmas. Henry treated the borough to an unusually long trading period allowed by the charter. Hull, for example, was allowed only 35 days. An additional order meant that the loading of ships anywhere between Ravenscar and Flamborough was forbidden, except at Scarborough. The annual fair in Scarborough soon became the busiest fish market in Western Europe and welcomed many visitors and merchants to buy, sell and be entertained. The 45-day open market period coincided with the vast shoals of herring travelling southwards and coming close to Scarborough in August and September, and this attracted merchant ships from other English ports. A large proportion of foreign merchants came into Scarborough, coming from Flanders. The remainder were mainly French. Some merchants came from Norway, Denmark and Germany, although they mainly travelled to Hull. Cargoes coming into the port at Scarborough included timber, pitch, wax, coal, Spanish iron and rice. But foreign interest was chiefly in fishing, and the number of merchants vastly increased in August and September to coincide with the shoals of herring. When Seymour Fair was granted its own charter in 1383, this posed a serious threat to Scarborough, and Scarborough Fair ended in 1788. The love ballad, Scarborough Fair, dates back to at least the 17th century, and the writer is unknown. It describes the impossible tasks that a young man sets for his lover in order to bring him back to her. His lady in turn requests equally impossible tasks from him. There are different views on the exact meaning of the ballad and to what extent the lyrics are the original.
The Vikings. The origin of the name Scarborough is uncertain. One theory is based on evidence found in an Icelandic saga, the Cormags saga. Suggesting a Viking origin, the saga records a Viking named Thorgil Skathi and his brother, who harried Ireland, Wales, England and Scotland. They were thought to be distinguished men who established a fort called Skardeberg, meaning Skathi's stronghold. Vikings did settle heavily in Yorkshire and often named places after people's names or nicknames. An alternative theory is that the name Scarborough comes from Old English for the hill with the fort, which could refer to the old Roman signal station on top of Castle Hill. The name may even be a blend of Old English and Viking Old Norse, which were similar languages. There is no archaeological evidence for a Viking or Anglo-Saxon settlement at Scarborough dating before the chapel, which was built on the ruins of the Roman signal station in around the year 1000 AD. Little is known about Scarborough around the time of the Norman conquest either. The Domesday Book, a survey of English land in 1086, does not mention it, the coast being part of the manor of Falsgrave. Some believe that a settlement at Scarborough was destroyed in 1066 by a Scandinavian invasion led by Harald Hardrada and Tostig Gudvinson, based again on evidence from Icelandic sagas. We can be more certain about Scarborough's history after the building of Scarborough's first castle in the 1130s. Henry II, King of England from 1154 to 1189, acquired the area as crown land in 1155 and began rebuilding Scarborough Castle in 1159, and soon after granted Scarborough the status of a town by giving it a royal charter in around 1163. This town status required a new tax to be paid to the crown, amounting to £20 a year in 1163, rising to £30 in 1169 as the town grew around the castle. Scarborough developed economically around fishing, the export of wool and the skilled labour needed to build the castle. St Mary's Church was also built at this time.
Sir Alan Akebourne. Born in London in 1939, Sir Alan Akebourne is one of Britain's most successful and prolific playwrights, as well as a world-renowned director of In the Round staging. He has received more than 35 awards and honours, including a Tony and two Olivier Awards. In 1987, he was awarded a CBE, and was knighted in 1997 for services to theatre. Almost half of his plays have been performed on London's West End, where, in 1975, he had five plays running simultaneously, as well as three on Broadway in New York. Sir Alan got his first theatre job at the age of 17 as acting stage manager at the Edinburgh Festival, and in 1957 was employed by the director Stephen Joseph in a similar role at the Library Theatre in Scarborough, which he had been founded in 1955 on the first floor of the public library on Vernon Road. Stephen Joseph was passionate about supporting new playwrights and challenged Alan to write his own play after hearing his comments on the quality of another playwright's script. The following year saw the premiere of Akeborn's first play, The Square Cat, at the Library Theatre. Alan Akeborn is deeply committed to regional theatre and as of 2022 has written 87 plays, almost all of which have premiered in Scarborough. In 1972, he became artistic director of the Library Theatre and was involved in its move to new premises in 1976 and again to its present home at the Stephen Joseph Theatre on Westborough, formerly the Odeon Cinema. He stepped down from that role in 2009. Sir Alan's plays have entertained and delighted audiences for over five decades and enriched Scarborough's cultural reputation. He's well known for his satirical portrayals of middle-class English life, but also addresses serious human themes, especially the difficulties of relationships and the failure of men and women to understand each other. As a writer and a director, he is a master of innovation. In the play Way Upstream, 1983, the staging involved a real waterway and a moving boat.
Football. Scarborough Football Club was originally formed in 1879 by members of the town's cricket team, initially playing their matches at the North Marine Road and competing in the Northern League. It was also there that they first played in the FA Cup in 1887. The club moved to the athletic ground on Seymour Road in 1898, and this was their home until 2007. In 1998 it became known as the McCain's Stadium in a pioneering sponsorship deal. They joined the Midland League in 1927 and became champions of that league 3 years later. In the same year, they managed to get to the third round of the FA Cup, a feat which they repeated 7 years later in 1937-38. The club's most successful period started in 1968, when their performances led to an invitation to play in the new Northern Premier League. And over the next 10 years, they would be at Wembley four times to play in the final of the FA Challenge Trophy. And in three of those, 72-73, 75-76 and 77-78, they came away with the trophy, the first club to become three times winners, and they were runners-up in 1974-75. In 1987, Neil Warnock was taken on as manager, and in the same year they were the first club to gain automatic promotion to the Football League 4th Division. A year later, they were in the playoffs to seek promotion to the third division, but lost out to Leyton Orient. Neil Warnock was then attracted to the job at Notts County. From that time, they had mixed fortunes, but did manage some giant killing in cup competitions. In 1989, they beat Chelsea 3-2 at home in a replay after a 1-1 draw at Stamford Bridge. Their best run saw them beat Bradford City, Coventry City and Plymouth Argyle in the 1992-93 season. However, the early years of the new century were difficult times for the club, and they were wound up in 2007 with debts of £2.5 million, and their ground was subsequently used for housing. Since then, they have risen from the ashes in the form of Scarborough Athletic Football Club. The Titanic. Scarborough has two important connections to the RMS Titanic. The ship was built by Scarborough-born Sir Edward Harland's company, Harland and Wolff. Harland was born in 1831 and raised at 10 Newborough, Scarborough, today the site of Marks and Spencer. One of 10 children born to a prominent local doctor and inventor, Dr. William Harland, and his wife, Edward had a passion for engineering. He moved to Belfast in 1854 to manage a shipyard, and in 1858 Harland bought the company, and in partnership with his personal assistant, Gustav Wolff, he built an extremely successful company, employing thousands and building some of the fastest ships to cross the Atlantic. Edward married Rosa Wan in 1860. They had no children. He retired from his company when he became the MP for Belfast North in 1889, having been knighted and made a baronet in 1885. He remained as MP until his death in 1895. James Moody was born on the 21st of August 1887 at South Cliff in Scarborough, the son of a solicitor. At 14, Moody left Scarborough to train to be a ship's officer, spending 1902 and 1903 as a cadet on HMS Conway. From there, Moody worked his way up, eventually joining White Star Lines in 1911. A year later, Moody accepted the job of sixth officer on board the Titanic, at that time the largest ship ever built. In a letter to his parents, he wrote, "I cannot describe any part of a ship which needs 85 clocks and 16 pianos to furnish it." On the fourth day of the voyage, in 15th of April 1912, ship's lookout Frederick Fleet rang the warning bell and telephoned the bridge. It was 11:35 p.m. Moody took the call and asked, "What do you see?" "Iceberg right ahead," was the response. Moody, the first of the bridge crew to be aware of the iceberg, immediately repeated the message to First Officer Murdoch. The ship struck the iceberg less than a minute later. Moody then supervised the loading and launching of lifeboats, helping to save many lives. He went down with the ship, and his body was never found.
Anne Bronte. Anne Bronte was born in 1820 near Bradford, as the youngest of the Bronte sisters. Her older sisters, Charlotte and Emily, were also well known for their novels and poetry. She worked as a governess for the Robinson family of Thorpe Green Hall, York, from 1840 to 1845. Anne accompanied the family on their annual summer holidays in Scarborough, staying at Wood's Lodgings on St. Nicholas Cliff, built on the site of what became the Grand Hotel. They attended services at Christchurch on Vernon Road. Anne's brother, Bramwell, was also in Scarborough in 1843, working as a tutor. While in Scarborough, Anne developed an interest in geology, collecting stones like carnelians. Carnelian Bay was recommended to tourists, and agates that were found along the coast or sold in a number of shops in town. Her novels, Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, would later reflect her experiences in the town. Anne suffered from influenza from late 1848 and was diagnosed with tuberculosis in January 1849. She was advised by a doctor that change of air would be helpful. Despite her weak condition, she and her friend Ellen Nussey travelled by train to Scarborough in May 1849. They arrived on Friday and on that day bought tickets for the Spa and walked along Spa Bridge and the beach. Anne died 2 days later on the Sunday, aged 29. It was her sister Charlotte who decided she should be buried in Scarborough rather than the family cemetery in Haworth, because of Anne's love of the town. Her brother Branwell and sister Emily had both died in 1848. You can visit Anne's grave in St Mary's churchyard. Just follow the signs from the South Bay.
Gristhorpe Man. Around 4,000 years ago, a warrior chieftain, today known as Gristhorpe Man, was buried in a large oak tree coffin inside a barrow or burial mound near Scarborough. This kind of burial is rare, particularly in this area, and with the range of goods within the coffin, it was immediately assumed that he was a high-status individual. The burial took place around the time that Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids were built. He was discovered on local landowner William Beswick's estate on the 10th of July 1834, when workmen were digging in a 40-foot diameter mound situated near the cliff edge at nearby Gristhorpe. They came across an immense log of wood, which, when it fell open the next day, it exposed a complete 6-foot-tall skeleton, partially wrapped in an animal skin cloak, along with a collection of tools, including a bronze dagger blade and whalebone pommel, flints, and a vessel containing food residue. The recovered skeleton underwent a series of conservation and preservation techniques, including being boiled in a glue solution, prior to being wired together for the purposes of display. He has been described as arguably the best preserved 4,000-year-old skeleton in Britain. Extensive scientific research on the skeleton revealed that he was in his early 60s when he died, and had lived in the area most of his life. He had usually been in good health, was combative, but benevolent and quick-witted. He was tall and muscular and had lived on a rich and carefully prepared diet. It was presumed that he was part of a local ruling family. His death was relatively sudden and was probably created by a brain tumour. Gristhorpe Man can be seen in the Rotunda Museum.
Boxing Day. The Fisherman v Fireman Charity football match is held annually on Boxing Day morning at the South Bay Sands. The tradition began in 1893 when it was held to provide for the widows and orphans of five men on board the fishing vessel Evelyn Maud, which sank during a terrible storm that November. The crew were never found, but some of the boat's life buoys washed up near Spurn Point, bearing the message, "Ship going down, sinking fast." Those lost were skipper William Mann, father and son Charles and Richard Whittaker, Daniel Reeder and John Eaves, each left behind a widow and in total 13 children. The boat's owner, Edmund Reynolds, partnered with councillor Joseph Hopwood and the mayor, George Beefoth, to create a charity fund attracting donations from local trawler owners and fishermen, and also from street collections, concerts, and the first Fisherman v Fireman match, played between fishermen, skippers, mates and deckhands, and ship's firemen, stokers, engineers and cooks. In 1893, around 15,000 people turned out to see the firemen win 4-1, and over £9 was raised, enough to justify a repeat of the event. Money continued to be raised for the Evelyn and Maud families, but later other local causes were supported too. The tradition of playing in fancy dress was started in 1903 by skipper Ben Crawford, and a small child, both wearing what was described as grotesque costume. In 1898, the match was played on the beach for the first time and moved to Boxing Day morning instead of Christmas Day, with some music and comedy also added. The match is not to be taken too seriously, A comedy element was introduced in 1945 when kicking the ball without wearing a top hat was recorded as a foul for the first time. It is now part of a Boxing Day set of charity events, including a fancy dress swim in the sea and a raft race held in the harbour, making Boxing Day in Scarborough a great destination for a fun day out.
Tunny fishing. For about 20 years, between 1930 and 1950, Scarborough became the centre of the sport of tunny fishing in Britain. Local fishermen had spotted these while fishing for herring, many believing them to be sharks. The first tunny, or Atlantic bluefin tuna, was caught in Scarborough in September 1929, when Lorenzo Mitchell Henry, who had learned the sport in Canada and Denmark, brought in the first rod-caught tunny fish. The majority of tunny were caught between 25 and 75 miles offshore, near the herring shoals, on which they fed, and this was between June and October. After reaching herring shoals, anglers usually switched to a rowing boat to hook the fish, which would begin a long fight to reel it in. One participant, Mr. B. Cliver Smith, reported being towed 25 miles for over 6 hours before landing his tunny fish. The sport quickly developed official rules using specialised tackle. Scarborough became the home of the British Tunny Club, which was founded in 1933, and anglers competed for the Paul Latham Challenge Cup, awarded for the heaviest tunny caught each season, with the Ward Challenge Cup being awarded to women anglers. Colonel E.T. Peel broke the world record in 1932 with a 798-pound tunny 7 miles from Scarborough. This was beaten in the following year when the heaviest was caught by Mr. Mitchell Henry with an 851-pound tunny in 1933. It was almost 9 feet long, that's 2.7 metres, and with a circumference of 6.7 feet, which is 2 metres. This still stands as the British record rod and line catch. He successfully challenged a catch, initially weighing in at 852 pounds, on the ground that a heavier rope had been used in the weighing. Tunny fishing attracted the wealthy, aristocrats and film stars, who rented keelboats for around £80 per week. That was a great sum in those days. Aviator Thomas Sopwith, Baron Henri de Rothschild, Walter Guinness and Scarborough-born Oscar winner Charles Laughton took part. But there is little evidence to the claim that John Wayne did also. Colonel Peel was one of the most successful tunny anglers and he became president of the British Tunny Club. World War II and declining tunny numbers put an end to tunny fishing in Scarborough.
Coastal erosion. The Holbeck Hall Hotel was originally built in 1883 as a private mansion for Mr. George Alderson Smith, one of the area's most successful trawler owners, who lived there until his death in 1931. It was then bought by the Laughton family, who already ran a number of local hotels. On Friday the 4th of June 1993, around 7 in the morning, guests were awoken after cracks were discovered in the gardens by a local dog walker who informed the hotel. Guests that morning had noticed wall cracks and jammed doors. The 50 guests were quickly evacuated without their belongings when 14 feet of lawn was lost as they got ready. They were later asked to settle their bills, but not charged for breakfast. The landslide had begun on Thursday evening, and small cracks had been noticed by the council in recent weeks along footpaths below. A landslip carried the gardens 200 feet down into the sea, at its fastest claiming 10 feet of land per hour. The conservatory and restaurant followed, with the final collapse happening on the Saturday night, with the northeast wing, which was pulled down. Much of the contents of the hotel were lost, including a valuable painting. Press and media swarmed to the site, and footage of the collapse was shown around the world. Although the East Coast cliffs are subject to constant attack and undermining from wave action, and clifftop homes are regularly lost, this was not caused by the sea. Investigation showed that this was a classic landslip caused by consecutive dry summers, which had created cracks in the boulder clay, followed by winter rains, which then entered these cracks and lubricated the clay soil. After demolition, the area was stabilized with geotextile bags, like sandbags, and 30,000 tons of rock armor in a £2 million scheme.
Shipbuilding. Shipbuilding was for centuries a leading industry in Scarborough. The harbour at South Bay had maintained fishing boats since the town's earliest days, but in the 17th century production expanded. The large supply of oak from North Riding and cheaper labour than yards on the Thames made Scarborough's yards a success. Encouraged by the demand for colliers for Newcastle and Sunderland, Scarborough was for a time the leading collier-owning port in England. The most successful shipbuilders in Scarborough were the Tyndall family, whose production made up between two-fifths and two-thirds of Scarborough's total between the early 18th century and their yard closing in 1863. Most of their ships were brigs or barks, with a smaller number of snows. Smaller ships were mostly built for residents of Scarborough or the Yorkshire coast, and larger ships were added to the Tyndall's own fleet. Some of the larger ships were destined to become Baltic traders, and they were cheaper to operate and carried a large amount of less valuable cargo. Shipbuilding took place along the foreshore between the King Richard III house, once home to the Tyndall family, and the Castle Hill, protected by the harbour. At its peak, as many as 11 shipyards lined the foreshore, mingled with shops working rope, sails, iron and timber. But unfortunately for Scarborough, the size of the harbour could not keep up with the increasing size of ships in the 19th century, and the industry did not adapt to iron shipbuilding. Two Scarborough-built vessels served as convict transporters in the First Fleet, which transported 800 convicts to Botany Bay, which is just south of Sydney, Australia, and that was in 1787. A quarter of the first 800 convicts transported on the eight-month voyage were women. One vessel, called the Scarborough, carried 208 male convicts, and the Friendship, the other vessel, took 124 men and women. These founded the first European colony in Australia.
Grand Hotel. Following the development of the railway in 1845, visitors began to arrive in Scarborough in far greater numbers. Looking to profit from this increased tourism, a group of Yorkshire businessmen bought a site on St Nicholas Cliff and appointed the architect Cuthbert Brodrick, who had designed Leeds Town Hall, to design a magnificent hotel, initially known as the Cliff Hotel. It's said that the original design was symbolic, with four towers, 12 floors, 52 chimneys and 365 rooms, representing the seasons, months, weeks and days of the year, although the finished build did not fully conform to this. It was sold unfinished in 1865 for £100,000, a significant loss to the sellers. The new owners, Grand Hotel Limited, spent the next 2 years completing it. It used 6 million bricks, 40,000 cubic feet of stone, and the public area was carpeted with 11.5 miles of carpet. The magnificent exterior of the hotel was matched by a luxurious interior, with an imposing main staircase, a half-moon-shaped ballroom, and the dining room. On the first floor, guests would find the exquisitely decorated drawing room. Rooms were appointed with huge bathrooms to provide its wealthy clientele with space for one or two servants to help with dressing them, and guests could choose to fill their bath with fresh or sea water, this being drawn directly from the sea by a pipeline. During the First World War, the Grand Hotel sustained some damage during the German Navy bombardment, although happily no one was injured. By 1930, inflation had begun to affect the economy, and prices at the hotel had risen to 12 and 6, 62p, for a single room per night. But the Grand Hotel continued to be the place to stay in Scarborough. Winston Churchill stayed at the hotel several times and had a particular fondness for room 140. When World War II began in 1939, the hotel was requisitioned by the RAF to house trainees, and during this time parts of the interior were badly damaged, so that £100,000 had to be spent on refurbishment before the hotel reopened in 1947. By the 1970s, cheap package holidays had lured increasing numbers of people away from the traditional British seaside resort, and there was concern that the Grand Hotel may be converted into holiday flats. In fact, it was purchased by Butlins in 1979, attracting fresh customers and an investment of £2.5 million in refurbishments.
Oliver's Mount. Firstly, Oliver's Mount is named after Oliver Cromwell, whose army is believed to have sighted guns at that location during the English Civil War of 1642 to 1651. You may wish to refer to another stayboard on the trail referring to the siege of Scarborough Castle during that war. Now, the racing circuit on Oliver's Mount came about because of the enthusiasm of the Scarborough and District Motor Club, who, inspired by the classic road races taking place elsewhere, had been searching for a venue since the mid-1930s. After World War II, they renewed their efforts and the Oliver's Mount circuit was opened in September 1946, the first race meeting being watched by a crowd of over 12,000 spectators, and it is defined as a street racing circuit because it uses public roads and is the only such circuit in England. The 2.5-mile racecourse proved popular with both public and the racing riders of the time, and BBC's decision to cover the race meetings increased its popularity. But the tightness and hilly nature of the course, together with the number of hairpin bends, were punishing on the bikes. And at the riders' request, significant improvements were made in the first few years, and by 1951, the circuit was also fully compliant with the new stringent safety rules. It was a favourite with Barry Sheen, who won the Gold Cup four times amongst his 15 race wins. Racing history, including some tragic events, have led to the naming of some of the circuit's features, including Sheen's Rise, Jeffrey's Jump, named after David Jeffries, a five times winner of the Gold Cup in between 1992 and 2001, who was spectacular at high-speed wheelies. Ever more stringent safety rules and accidents have from time to time caused the popular circuit to be closed in some years, resulting in the absence of the roar of the bikes, which has been heard across the town because of the elevated position of the circuit. The bombardment. Shortly after 8 a.m. on the 16th of December 1914, two German battlecruisers, the Van der Tann and the Derfflinger, appeared out of the morning mist, and at a range of about 1 mile attacked Scarborough, firing over 700 shells in less than 30 minutes. The first salvos appeared to be targeting what could be military targets, including the coastal signal station and the castle headland. Soon, however, they were firing at the town itself in a more indiscriminate manner, hitting over 200 houses, 7 churches and 10 public buildings. The Grand Hotel took over 30 shells, one passing through the lighthouse tower before it exploded at the hotel. The tower had to be demolished several days later and was only rebuilt in 1931. 18 men, women and children died in the attack, and many more were injured. A 15-year-old boy, George Taylor, was killed on his way to buy a newspaper, and a postman died whilst on his early round. In the most tragic incident, a mother and 3 children died as a result of an explosion in Wycombe Street. Now, many believe the attack to be a prelude to a German invasion and, in panic, took to the railway station and roads leading out of the town in a bid to escape. It's not clear why Scarborough was chosen, but the Germans hoped that causing civilian fear and panic would undermine British morale. The German fleet was also keen to lure the Royal Navy out to engage them in battle in the open seas, and the attack served as a diversion to enable another of the German ships, a light cruiser, the Kolberg, to lay mines between Filey and Flamborough Head. The attack, which led to Winston Churchill describing the Germans as baby killers, was used by the British government as a recruiting sergeant in the Remember Scarborough campaign.
First seaside resort. Scarborough became a spa town when Mrs. Thomason Farrer discovered its apparently medicinal spa waters. Mrs. Farrer came from a wealthy and influential local family. Her brother and father each represented Scarborough in Parliament. Spa waters were already attracting people to towns like Bath and Buxton. The precise date of the discovery in Scarborough is not certain, although it's likely to be 1626, based on 17th century texts. The story goes that Mrs. Farrer had noticed that the water stained the bottom of the cliff in a reddish brown and wondered what was in the water causing this. Similar staining is still visible at a small well near the steps from the spa complex down to the beach. In the 1660s and 70s, medical books discussed the benefits of drinking Scarborough spa waters for various ailments. Dr. Whitty suggested a pint of the water in the morning, followed by a walk along the beach, as a routine to be followed for a month or more. Scarborough developed as Britain's first seaside resort when large numbers of visitors arrived to take these spa waters, and subsequently to enjoy the health benefits of sea swimming. In the words of local historian Trevor Pearson, in the 100 or so years that followed the end of the English Civil War, it is not an exaggeration to say that Scarborough invented the seaside holiday. It is noted that 2026 is the 400th anniversary of these events. By the 1740s, well-to-do people from urban communities in the north of England and further afield were making regular visits in large numbers for the spa waters, sea swimming and evening entertainment, such as gambling and dancing. Bathing machines were fashionable for women who fancied a modest dip in the sea and used in Scarborough from 1735. The Scarborough Spa funicular cliff lift opened in 1875 as the South Cliff Tramway and is Britain's oldest. At around 87 metres long, it connects the spa with the South Cliff Esplanade above, where its numerous hotels welcomed the first holidaymakers. This railway originally used an engine pumping seawater to add weight to the top car until its tank was heavy enough to act as a counterweight to pull up the lower car. The cliff lift was immediately popular, carrying 1,400 passengers on its first day. At its peak in the 1945-6 season, it was used by 1.22 million people. Today, the system is automated and electric. Four further cliff lifts were built in Scarborough, only one of which, the Central Tramway, still operates.